This podcast has ended and is no longer being updated. The company, Yizzy Research, no longer exists, nor does the coaching program or website. Please disregard any mention of these. You're listening to the Yizzy Research Podcast, hosted and created by me, Imani, a researcher. This is the podcast for people who research people. In this episode, I speak with Mandy.
My name is Mandy Hall, and I am a senior user experience researcher at Microsoft Research in the Health Futures group, and I'm the solo member of the Medical Experiences and Design team. So I currently support all the teams on Health Futures, and really prior to joining Microsoft, I worked as a human factors engineer at Kestra Technologies, which is a startup, and then prior to that, I worked in home healthcare, doing patient coordination, community liaison type work, and I even led a telehealth program.
Have you heard of ambidextrous research? It's not research about being able to use both hands equally well. Mandy's done a lot in her career, including voice of the customer work and ambidextrous research, and she tells us about it.
So recently I've been very interested in this idea of ambidextrous research. And as a user experience researcher, we spend a lot of time looking at exploratory as well as delivery type of research. And it can fall into different types of nomenclature to describe this type of research. Other terms are foundational, generative, formative, summative. But really, ambidextrous research is the ability to do product discovery and product delivery in parallel. And this stems from the ability of organizations to conduct exploration and exploitation research simultaneously. And this idea is further explored in the book, The Invincible Company. Are you familiar with this book?
I am not familiar with that one. I have a very long TBR list, so I'll add that one to it.
Well, it's not a very long read. It kind of goes through little snippets, business models. It'll kind of tickle your imagination. And really what this book states that for a company to be invincible, it needs to constantly reinvent itself before it becomes obsolete, which involves exploring the future while excelling at exploiting the present. It cultivates an innovation and execution culture that lives in harmony. So I like to use the analogy really of being ambidextrous with both your hands, being able to be very skilled at writing or completing tasks with both your left and right hand. So if you think about an ambidextrous organization, my dominant hand is my right hand. So I don't really think about using it from day to day. I can easily write. And so if you think about this in the analogy of an organization, this is your day-to-day business. This is what your current customers, the types of markets you're in, the type of technology, if you're in the tech industry, that your customers are using. And then you go to my non-dominant hand, which is my left hand. And really this hand is a little more difficult for me to control and for me to write and do tasks with. And this really represents being creative and innovative. So, for an organization, and this idea of ambidextrous research is really being able to be good at both these types of tasks.
And you mentioned innovation as an important part of ambidextrous research. Innovation depends on two things generally. What are those two things?
Yes. So innovation does depend on two things. And I like to think of these two things in the form of questions. So the first question being, does the innovation create a new market or address the existing market? And does the innovation use a new technology or an existing technology? So really, if you picture, there's various different types of innovation. And if you picture this on an X and Y graph and four quadrants, or, maybe a better way to visualize it is a 2x2 factorial design, with the x-axis being as technology, with two quadrants labeled existing and new technology, and the y-axis as market, with two quadrants labeled existing and new markets.
innovation isn't necessarily just innovation. There are different types of innovation. So what are some different types of innovation, and what are some examples of those different types?
There's four different types of innovation, and I'll have examples of each one. But let's visualize this picture of to kind of help with this explanation. Is like picture an X and Y graph with four quadrants, or 2x2 factorial design, with the x-axis as technology with two quadrants labeled existing and new technology, and the y-axis as market with two quadrants labeled existing and new markets. And so keeping with the X and Y graph visual, let's talk about four types of innovation and where they lie within the four quadrants. So let's start with the left quadrant, representing an existing market and existing technology. So this is incremental innovation. Incremental innovation can be described as making improvements on an existing product or service. Have you purchased a razor lately?
I have, actually. I purchased a pack of razors last week.
In that packet of razors, how many blades did you buy on the razor?
I think maybe three or four.
So three or four, yeah. So this is a great example of this idea of incremental innovation. For example, Gillette changed from a single razor blade to double to now up to six blades. So you go to the store and you're overwhelmed. It's like, do I just want one blade? Do I want two blades? Three? And now there's already up to six. So this is incremental innovation, which is small, but the example is such that showcases how, you know, maybe the one wasn't really meeting a lot of market needs, or and then that existing market and existing technology, and just keep increasing the number of blades. So that's an example of incremental innovation. Okay, now let's move to the right quadrant, representing new technology but an existing market. And this is disruptive innovation, an innovation that conflicts with and threatens to replace traditional approaches to competing within an industry. When you're working day to day, or do you interact with any type of computers?
Yes, I do.
Okay. So, you know, keeping with this disruptive innovation, think back to, you know, maybe you're too young for this, but did you ever work on a desktop computer?
Yes, I grew up, we had the Gateway desktop, I think, like the cow printed branding.
Yeah, so these big clunky computers, they're not mobile. They're very difficult to take with you. And so an example of disruptive innovation would be Apple's iPad or tablets, or in laptops such as the Surface that we have at Microsoft. So now you've just disrupted the whole idea of what a computer is. You don't have these giant computers and years ago where it would fill up a whole warehouse. you have to interact with it in this one location, and then it evolved to being able to sit on your desktop, to now you can really bring your computer with you and get access to Wi-Fi, and everything's very mobile. So that's really disrupted this idea of this desktop computer as it became more of a disruptive innovation. So now let's move to the right top quadrant, representing new technology and new market. And this is radical innovation. Radical innovation is when new products or services are developed using new technology that open up new markets. So examples of this are new medications to treat known diseases, such as Aricept, that helps treat the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. So if you think about it, when you have new technology developed, or medical, this would be an example of medical discovery, where previously there were no drugs to treat this type of disease. And now with this radical innovation, you now have a new medication that can treat this type of disease. So moving to the top left quadrant, representing existing technology and a new market, this is architectural innovation. And this type of innovation occurs when new products and services use existing technology to create new markets and or new consumers that did not purchase that item before. So can you think of any, so Imani, let's try to find an example of how this plays out in current terms. Do you have a cell phone?
Yes, I have it right here. People can't see it, but I have an iPhone.
Okay, yeah, so it seems like, you know, most people carry around this cell phone. So this architectural innovation, keeping with this type of innovation, have you added on or any type of other devices that you can access similar things on your phone?
So I have a MacBook. So my MacBook and my iPhone talk to each other if I want them to. Like with the photos, for example, if I take a photo on my phone, I have the iCloud. I can view them on my laptop as well.
Yeah, excellent. So that's like transfer. But the example, I know I don't have this, but if you think about this smartwatch, where they take this existing cell phone technology and then they repackaged it into a watch. So, you know, for example, this opened up a new market of purchasers by repackaging an existing technology. And I don't have this either. I have a Fitbit on right now. But you see people all the time now just wearing and having all access to text messages, calls just on their wrist. So, you know, this idea of, you know, going from, you know, given your example, you have this laptop, and now really you could access most things through the phone. So there's a lot of architectural innovation that has taken place, and many other examples we can see as you're going through your day-to-day interaction with technology. Okay, Imani, are you ready for a quiz based on this explanation that I just provided?
Yes, I was listening intently, so I'm ready.
Okay, excellent. So let me get started. So let's test your knowledge. The example being an insulin administered via inhaler versus injected. And this would be for to help treat type 1 diabetes.
I'm going to say disruptive because insulin already existed, but not through an inhaler form.
So that's a great guess. I love that. Do you have any other possible types of innovation this could be?
Maybe radical.
Radical, because radical is a new technology, but a new market. But let's imagine that there are, you know, currently those that have type 1 diabetes only have the ability to inject insulin.
So maybe incremental?
Yes, exactly. That's right. Yeah, because it was already an existing technology, which is this idea of insulin and an existing market. And now there's an incremental change in how users can get the benefits of the insulin and administer that. So let's move on to where would a wearable defibrillator be? So just to give you a little more kind of insight into what a wearable defibrillator is, currently patients will get pacemakers, or if they have a sudden cardiac arrest, there would be an AED. Someone would come, and there have to be a bystander that would then help shock and regulate and get the heart back into a normal rhythm. So think about this idea of a wearable defibrillator, where this device would automatically detect a sudden cardiac arrest and then treat the patient. So there's already this existing market of those that are at risk for a heart attack or sudden cardiac arrest. And currently there's only they only have the ability to have a bystander administer that treatment or get, if they're at high risk, get a pacemaker. Where do you think that type of product would fall?
Disruptive.
That's right. Disruptive innovation. So let's move on to another example. Let's keep testing, see if we can apply these types of innovation to this new example in healthcare. So, you know, imagine that there's only the ability to conduct x-rays. And there's been a new machine, and it's an MRI. So it uses electromagnetic forces instead of x-rays to produce images internal to the body. So now this new type of technology is generated to be able to take images internal to the user in a new way.
I'm thinking architectural.
That is a good, yeah. But think about it in, is this a new technology? And then there's new uses because you can use MRI in unique ways to really get a sense of what's happening inside the body and the new images to treat.
maybe radical or...
That's right. It's radical.
Radical, okay.
Okay, these are hard because these, how, you know, I kind of made this hard. This is my domain. You're really being a good sport on this because this is super difficult. The razors are a little more a pedestrian type of example because they're widely understood. But yeah, these healthcare examples are tough. So, and then the next example, so maybe we can just eliminate process of elimination here with the four different types of innovation is this. Imagine the next generation of genetic sequencing to identify at-risk patients or target therapies. So you're taking existing technology, mm-hmm. and you're able to really sequence and do more with this type of technology to really identify at-risk populations and then further to do to target therapeutics and create new and find new therapeutics to treat these types of new medical discovery work.
Architectural.
You're right.
These were tough.
These are really tough, and I mean, it's not you know, you got to really think through. I really try to take the existing new and market technology, and it's really tough. Yeah.
So we talked a lot about the different types of innovation, right? We talked about the fact that innovation depends on market and technology. Then you talked about the four quadrants, and we talked about architectural, radical, incremental, and disruptive innovation. How can researchers support an ambidextrous organization to be invincible with UX research with all of this knowledge in mind?
I believe that UXR researchers, they're underutilized in organizations, given their capacity and ability to drive product delivery and product discovery. So if you think about how can researchers support an ambidextrous organization to be invincible with user experience research, I really consider this to operate in product delivery UXR, which involves focusing on current customers, markets, and technology. And a user experience researcher could do this by conducting rapid discovery research, conducting UXR sprints ahead of engineering builds, usability informative studies, interview stakeholders, customers, conducting UX competitive analyses. And so these are just some examples of how user experience researchers can really help engage and drive product delivery. And then you look at the other side, which is this idea of the product discovery UXR support, which involves focusing on new customers, markets, and technology. And this includes exploratory research, ideation sessions to spark innovation ideas, really identify and understand problems, and think about some innovative types of solutions to address those problems, assessing future trends, and really interviewing and interacting with stakeholders, but these types of interpreters. So interpreters, finding these types of individuals that are gifted and just really doing research and predicting future trends. And then helping teams reimagine new workflows, new user experiences. You can do this through value propositions, prototyping, testing prototypes, testing new different types of solutions, and really pushing them to think about this new experience end to end and how that would manifest in a future world. So these are just two ways that user experience researchers can do this, and they can do this in parallel. They can divide up their research into different work streams and do this concurrently.
What's the difference between product delivery UX research and product discovery UX research?
The difference between product delivery and product discovery is really that product delivery involves focusing on current customers, markets, and technology. And the product discovery involves focusing on new customers, markets, and technology.
If you are an aspiring or current UX researcher who needs help with your resume, professional brand, interview skills, cover letter, LinkedIn profile, and portfolio, consider applying for the Yizzy Research Coaching Program. Coaching clients exit the program with a refreshed resume, cover letter, research portfolio, and detailed notes to make them more competitive in the UX research job market. If you are interested or know someone who is, visit yizziresearch.com to learn more and apply. That's Yizzi Research, Y-Z-Z-I, research.com. So we talked a lot about ambidextrous research. That was the first chunk of our conversation. And so I also wanted us to have some time to talk about voice of the customer as well, because you've had quite a bit of experience with that. What is the voice of the customer workstream?
So the voice of the customer workstream is a workstream involving engineering, product design, and user experience research. The idea of this the work stream and how I kind of combine and able to integrate and work with teams to conduct delivery and discovery product research is to kind of bring the team along the customer and research discovery and delivery journey to really build empathy and in a way co-design with users and the product teams to conduct UXR in a process and do this iteratively, kind of storytelling and discovering along with me that the customer engagement.
And how does ambidextrous research relate to a voice of the customer workstream?
The voice of the customer or voice of the user is a forum for user experience researchers to drive UX innovation through the discovery delivery process, to really create valuable and usable products for users, to identify user needs and that map to product requirements, to discover new customers and their user needs, such as new use cases or scenarios, to assess current user experience technology limitations, to inspire innovative solutions, really to evaluate current customers' UX challenges, to inform and improve product offerings, and create a feedback loop between product delivery, discovery work across teams to align on the end-to-end user experience.
That sounds very complex, so I want to break it down maybe into more digestible steps. What are some steps a researcher can take to create a VOC UXR workstream?
Seems complex and that a lot is being conducted. And so really the steps you can take to kind of create this voice of the customer, UXR workstream, is to really develop a research plan with the team you work with. Really working with that PM closely to understand some of the unanswered questions, their assumptions, their hypotheses, and really start on this discovery journey with them to uncover user needs that then can be mapped to engineering or product requirements. And so how I conducted this was really starting with this research plan and then having weekly meetings with collaborators, with different, with the UX team, with designers. And then I went through this phase of after meeting and working closely with my collaborators. Again, I conduct these in smaller groups once a week. And then I kind of developed within this plan, this rapid discovery research phase, where I did a deep dive into what is all current research that has been conducted in this domain, looking at the literature, looking at previous studies, previous work that has been conducted on our particular customer and area and type of technology. And then going through another phase of this exploratory research phase where I've now uncovered and there's a ton of unanswered questions and hypotheses and assumptions that we need to validate and gather evidence on. And so, you know, once I go through these are the first four steps. So you have develop research plan. And this involves really incorporating feedback and learnings through these weekly meetings, and then having conducted rapid discovery research phase, exploratory research phase, and these are ongoing work research that I conduct. And then all of these gathering this evidence, meeting, results in this VOC UXR work stream, which is you need to get buy-in. So the buy-in included this ability to become a official work stream to be able to report out all these interesting findings that I was uncovering during these research phases and this these collaborative meetings with partners and various teams that we work with. Finally, this all came to fruition in a monthly, I call it VOC, Voice of the Customer, Voice of the User UXR workstream sessions, where I'm now an active member in an active workstream and our monthly engineering meetings. So I report out on the research I'm doing. I answer any questions they have, and I really bring that voice of the customer, those examples, that discovery and exploratory work that I'm doing, and I report that back iteratively every month, and sometimes weekly. My sessions sometimes will carry on for multiple weeks within these weekly meetings. I'm only supposed to report out once a month, but many times there's so much engagement and so much interest, and I have conducted so much research that it's great to really be able to have that buy-in and that need from our larger engineering team and product team. They're hungry for that. They want to know more because it really helps them be thoughtful in the product requirements and how they're designing and developing.
And you mentioned getting buy-in. Which stakeholders do you need to get buy-in from in order to have a successful VOC program?
Yeah, the buy-in is key. So how you get buy-in to have a successful VOC program is that the PM is key to getting buy-in. And I partner with PMs to accelerate their impact and work, such as their ability to test market and customer assumptions to inform product requirements. And then it also involves the buy-in is, it also involves like really building a relationship with the teams I support and help gather evidence as quickly as possible to inform product development. I do this by conducting the foundational exploratory research, as well as through lean UX strategies, such as study designs to efficiently test product and customer hypotheses and assumptions and test prototypes. For example, doing usability studies, heuristic expert evaluations. And really this buy-in happens, and you show this buy-in and through credibility by showing how UXR can help prevent engineering waste, reduce product market risk, and really help uncover technology market insights. And we become this connector to the team, really closing team feedback loops and fostering company customer empathy to build better products faster.
When you were talking about some of the steps you can take to create a VOC UXR workstream, you mentioned obviously that buy-in was important. And also an important part of getting buy-in is keeping your stakeholders engaged. And you mentioned that there were monthly VOC workstream sessions. What did those sessions look like?
We have weekly engineering meetings with the team. And my workstream, one of those weekly meetings will be dedicated to just reporting out on UXR and VOC. And so what this looks like is I many times just every week do a quick report out about what I'm doing, similar to Scrum. I mean, if you look at an agile, I like a dual agile type of model. During that monthly session, that many times they want to hear more and I get more time even weekly now, it's been happening. And then I'll invite different speakers and customers to present to the team. I do this in the form of presentations, study findings, and also just facilitating brainstorming sessions with the team to get them to think about how we're going to design and develop things that help envision and help the user. So that kind of is a little bit about how these monthly workstream sessions play out.
And as these types of sessions are happening, what role do you as the researcher play as the team discusses these potential solutions? I know for me, when I give recommendations and solutions after research, depending on what the dynamic is of the team, you have to figure out what role you play in that context and how do you fit. So what are your thoughts on that?
The UXR role to play to help kind of facilitate discussion, the role becomes this role of connector where you're facilitating discussion, you're asking the customer-centered questions. You're being that voice of the user or customer. You know, what does the customer want? What are their needs? Are we thinking about them in the context of creating these requirements, of putting ourselves in the shoes of the customer or the potential user for these products we're designing? And really, are we mapping and understanding their needs and being thoughtful about that? So the UXR role is really that one of discussion. We always bring this back to the customer and really looking at it from their perspective and pushing the team to really be thoughtful in how they're thinking about solutions, how they're designing the back end to then connect with the front end and that UI or that the cognitive mapping of how customers do things and think about things, and even thinking about other products and their workflow, and really helping the team understand how customers and users currently do things. So, you know, you can imagine this example would be, imagine that we only had desktop computers and now all of a sudden phones are a new technology. So, you know, within that example, you could say the user experience researcher would come in and say, okay, what's a requirement? Now someone's mobile. Let's think about their environment. Let's think about the limitations they have. Is the screen too small? Can they carry it easily? Let's think about these requirements in the various contexts of how that user interacts with products and the problems they're trying to solve and the tasks they're trying to complete. So yeah, the role of the UXR really is to kind of connect those dots, really connect this, you know, concept to this actually well vetted out day-to-day experience that the user will encounter in their environment with that particular product.
And this question is a sticky and tricky question. And this is one question I and a lot of researchers get when we interview for research roles. And I don't always know how to answer this one. So I want to hear your take. What does the UX researcher do when stakeholders disagree with your findings?
Oh, Imani, yeah, this is so hard. The best thing about being a UXR researcher, as you know, is that we don't have all the answers. We just know how to gather evidence and engage stakeholders and get to the root cause of those of their problems, and then really to say, you know, if there's a disagreement, you know, how can we say, great, let's go look at let's see what the literature has to say. Let's go and talk to some users and ask them about this particular problem or whatever we're disagreeing on. And I'd love to use this example from one of my previous roles. I was a human factors engineer, and I was sitting in this room of all mechanical engineers, and they were all debating how big a button should be on this particular device, medical device I was working on. And they all had their own opinion. Some wanted it to be really small. Some wanted it to be a different color or a certain color. Some other people wanted to have a different texture. And so there's all this discussion going on about this button to turn on this device, this medical device. And so, you know, I just said, hey, let's go see what the literature has to say for this. And then let's go conduct a test to see what users think of these different types of buttons that you all are arguing about and what size it should be, what color it should be. So I quickly went and found this literature review on making recommendations for button sizes for a certain type of cohort of users. And we were designing this medical device for older adults. So it already gave some sort of foundational direction and requirements for how big a button should be for a certain type of user to be able to interact with. So I said, hey, here you go. Let's start with these different types of measurements for this button. And the engineers were like, great. And then the different engineers will go out and create really quickly mock-ups or prototypes. And this was a mechanical engineering, so actually they would create physical prototypes for me. And then I said, awesome, now let me just take this out to users. And I quickly spun up a usability study, and I just asked users. I gave them the simulated task to do, and I observed and got their feedback on, were they able to be able to find this button, push this button, interact with this button? What did they think about it? So this example shows that when there's a disagreement, the great part about being a UXR professional is that you say, okay, let's go gather some evidence to support these claims. If these are opinions, let's go out and figure out how to address this. Now, to your point, when there's disagreements and challenges that have to do with technology capabilities versus the engineering time, you're held to some, there's misalignments. Because I've run into this idea that, yeah, this is the optimal user experience that I would like and that users want, but there's limitations in the technology capabilities. There's limitations in our ability to work with manufacturers. It would take years for us to engineer or design that type of experience that you want. So that's when those, if you look at it from a disagreement on a perspective of what that user experience optimally should be, then that's harder. Then those are trade-offs you have to make as a team.
Just to try to connect everything that you mentioned about developing a research plan, having weekly meetings, rapid discovery, exploratory research, the work stream, buy-in from stakeholders, work stream sessions monthly, right? How to manage stakeholders who disagree with your findings. When you think about all this stuff together, how else does a VOC program manifest? So for example, are there repositories, readout decks, log analysis, et cetera?
You know, this idea of how do you do this iteratively where you're not creating friction and you're not slowing down engineering teams? So how do you report out and integrate the team to address, for example, these challenges and to really thoughtfully design these projects and adhere to these timelines? And that's why this VOC UXR workstream is so impactful, because I'm able to do this weekly and monthly, and I'm connecting with these teams, closing these feedback loops, and really reducing friction and addressing these challenges before they become, when they're just currently friction points and not battles or wars, for example, when you have teams that disagree with what they're doing, or they're just misalignments. So those, if you have this UXR VOC workstream, it really allows you to reduce that friction and really bring everyone together that UXR is so gifted at doing. And that's why I bring in customers. I bring in that sense of empathy through the presentations or readouts and decks or the deliverables that I present to the team is different each month. Sometimes they're discussions, and we've come across some misalignments between design, what design's doing in the front end and what's happening in the back end, for example. And then I can facilitate these discussions during these VOC sessions and address them and come to solutions that help move the project along faster.
And lastly, I want to leave with some more practical advice for UX researchers who have tried to implement a VOC program and weren't successful. What would you tell them to encourage them to try again?
For those researchers who have really tried to implement a VOC UXR workstream and weren't successful, or your readouts aren't well attended, or you're only able to get some buy-in, you're having a hard time getting buy-in. So really it includes a few things that you can do. You really have to build credibility in your brand, but also ask for a seat at the table. So I'm very forthright, and I ask to be in meetings that others do not think I need to be in. And I find this extremely useful to sit on engineering meetings and other planning meetings to see where I can best be plugged in and be able to assess the UXR needs of the team and really to understand those unanswered questions, then act fast to deliver. So if I'm not in those meetings, many times I find that, you know, depending on the maturity of the organization you work in and their buy-in to design and UXR work, that they don't know where to plug you in. They're not intentionally keeping you out of meetings. They just don't usually understand where you need to be plugged in at. So really, to be able to build credibility and really showcase and figure out how you best can support these projects, ask for a seat at the table, you know, ask to be in these meetings and then speak up and say, hey, that's something that UXR can address. You have an unanswered question. Let me go out and spin up a study real quick or gather some evidence in the literature. And then you come back and you say, hey, I have some evidence to support that claim or to support or answer that hypothesis or that assumption with evidence. And here's some customers I engaged with. You know, product teams love that and they want it fast. And so staying ahead of these builds and these requirements, and you can do that by being in these meetings and understanding the product roadmap. Another thing that needs to take place to be successful and really being able to implement this VOC UXR workstream is changing culture is also key to be successful. And really, I first focused on getting everybody to understand design thinking and how to use a customer-centered approach to product development. So this takes time and is vital for a company to be invincible. You're seeing this big trend happen right now that if you're not using a customer-centered approach, you're going to be left behind. You're not going to be creating products and addressing these problems and understanding the root cause of problems that users have and being thoughtful about how you're designing solutions to address those problems. So really, for a company to be invincible and not become obsolete, the UXR researchers are the hidden gems in companies that can facilitate, drive, and lead innovation for company success. So they need to be given a seat. They need to be given a seat at the table. So be patient. Don't give up. If you've tried to create a workstream, a VOC, a UXR workstream in the past, please don't give up. Find allies. Create a community within your organization and slowly grow that community. So for example, I'm just a solo UXR professional. I support multiple teams. And so I started this UXRD, so this User Experience Research and Design Health Collective, to bring together UX researchers and designers from across Microsoft working on health-related research and products to meet monthly to accelerate collaboration and our impact, as well as share resources. And this has been tremendously motivational and inspirational. And, you know, create a community, don't give up, find allies, and really ask for a seat at the table.
UX researchers can prevent companies from becoming obsolete by influencing innovation and uncovering what is not always obvious. I really like that perspective from Mandy. Working proactively and collaboratively is a good way to achieve this. Thanks for listening to the Yizzy Research Podcast, the podcast for people who research people. I'm Imani, the host and creator. Visit yizzyresearch.com for podcast show notes and information about my UX research coaching program. Again, that's yizzyresearch.com, Y-Z-Z-I, research.com. This podcast was produced by Whisper and Mutter.